Warning, the Not Real Art Podcast is intended for creative audiences only. The Not Real Art Podcast celebrates creativity and creative culture worldwide. It contains material that is fresh, fun and inspiring and is not suitable for boring old art snobs. Now, let's get started and enjoy the show. Oh, 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 oh.
Greetings and salutations, my creative brothers and sisters. Welcome to Not Real Art, the podcast where we talk to the world's most creative people. I am your host, faithful, trusty, loyal, tireless, relentless host, Sourdough, coming at you from Crew West Studio in Los Angeles. Man, do we have a fantastic artist for you today, the one and only John Houck. And I want to tell you about him, which I will do in a second, but please stay tuned because you're going to hear from him directly. Incredibly smart, talented, prolific artist I know you're going to love. But before we get into this, I want to thank you for tuning in. We so appreciate your loyalty. We do this for you. It's all about you. And let's see, of course, as always, go to notrealart.com. Check out all the good, healthy stuff we've got for you there. We want you to enjoy the remote series by Badir McClear, Exploring Public Art. It's an exclusive video series. Please check out the videos. They're amazing. I want you to check out our First Friday's online exhibitions, dropping once a month on the first Friday of each month. We've got some incredible shows for you there. Please check it out at notrealart.com. And of course, you can always discover incredible talent and artists at Not Real Art. So please go to the website and enjoy all the good, healthy stuff we've got for you there. But today we're going to hear from the one and only John Houck. John is an American multidisciplinary artist whose work is held in the collections of the Whitney, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Hammer, the Guggenheim, and the Museum of Modern Art, amongst other institutions. He is a graduate of the Whitney ISP, Skowhegan, and UCLA's MFA program. Central to Houck's practice is how shadows serve as signatures of both the condition and the limits of our experience. If everything we see is reflected light, then the world that shows up for us is by definition a world of shadows continuously cast upon us. From subtly folded and re-photographed monochromatic papers to paintings of psychological landscapes overlaid by objects personal to the artist, Houck recasts the shadow as a hinge of illusion and illumination, as the point at which what is real overlaps with what we can know and what we can imagine. Wow, really cool stuff. I love his work, and I love talking to John. We really hit it off, and just a really great, generous, smart, thoughtful guy, and I really enjoyed sitting down with him. Grateful that he was able to take time out of his busy schedule to come on the show and talk about his work. He has a show right now in New York that's happening as well that we'll talk about. But without further ado, let's get into this and we'll hear from the one and only John Houck. And you're going to hear for yourself what a talented, smart guy he is. So without further ado, let's get into this and hear from the one and only John Houck.
John Houck, welcome to Not Real Art.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Man, it's so great to have you here. Thank you for coming through.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
Man, so we're brought together by our mutual friends over at Inversion Arts, and what an exciting model they have. I'm so grateful that they connected us. Joey specifically, you know, has been on the show in the past. We love what they're doing to innovate, right?
Yep, I do too.
Yeah. I mean, how did they find you? Tell me a little bit about, you know, how you found them, how they found you.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw Jonathan Neal give a talk at Freeze, New York. I think it was 2 years ago. And I thought, wow, that sounds... He started to talk about inversion art a little bit in that talk. He was on a panel. And I thought, that sounds like a fascinating model. You know, I had worked, prior to becoming an artist, prior to grad school, I worked for Sun Microsystems, which was kind of like working for Google back in the day. It was a really amazing place. I was a software engineer there and, you know, familiar with tech incubators. And so I think that really resonated with me. Their model and the fact that they were coming out of a more tech-focused kind of, or trying to blend, let's say, the art world and the kind of tech incubator world. And so that hit me right away as something really fascinating. And then I met Joey and we talked about his experience at Y Combinator, which is a program that's always been really fascinating to me. I was a huge fan of Paul Graham back when I was a programmer and one of the co-founders there. And yeah, you know, I've read all of his stuff. He wrote this book, Hackers and Painters, that I really loved and almost precipitated my move toward painting and what I do now. So there was just a lot of history there, a lot of shared history. And once I met them both in person in LA, I was just like, yeah, we got to work together. We got to find a way to do something. And it's been great. You know, we've been working together officially since about last February.
So I can surmise, I know a little bit about inversion art and I've known Joey for a couple of years now, I think. So I'm sort of familiar in my own way what their pitch is and what their value proposition is. But for our listeners' sake, who might not know, in your own words, what is the value proposition as you understand it? And what was their pitch to you as an artist? How are they making your life easier, better, your practice easier and better? And what was that value? What does it mean to you as an artist?
It really comes down for me to two things. I think the first thing is studio management. Like they help with inventory and the kind of administrative stuff that one has to do while running a studio, things that no one really teaches you about in grad school and legal issues as they come up, all of those kind of things. So that's the one thing that's really helpful and very kind of utilitarian. And then the other side, the side that was most interesting to me actually was the kind of more strategic brainstorming, you know. So I meet with Jonathan and Joey and we talk through different ideas about ways I can kind of expand my art into different audiences, ways I can, well, a great example is, you know, I kind of transitioned from a gallery in New York to a different gallery and they helped me with that transition a lot. And it's really helpful to have somebody else. So, you know, of course, as an artist, you have your artist friends who have their opinions about the galleries, but it's nice to have somebody at another level in that conversation who kind of gets the really high level view of that territory, the galleries and how to navigate it. Friends always have very specific experiences and inversion art has a little like higher level kind of view of everything.
If I had to put it in my own words, I sort of, what I really love about what inversion art is doing is that they're creating a model where they're letting artists be artists, right? So for those artists that kind of engage with them or that they bring on, you get to have a thought partner. It's a little bit of a manager, agent, strategist, but then they're handling a lot of that back of house stuff or behind the scenes stuff that is the bane of our existence in many ways, right? And as an artist, right, you just want to make art. And years ago, I used to do some work in healthcare for a company called Kaiser Permanente. And part of their proposition to doctors was that, you know, we let doctors be doctors because doctors just want to practice medicine. They don't want to run an office necessarily. Some doctors do, but some doctors don't. And so anyway, the fact that inversion art is helping you, helping support you and create the space so that you can focus on your practice is revolutionary. It's beautiful.
It is. It's a really great model. And it is very helpful because your main partner historically as an artist has been a gallery and galleries have really tight schedules and they're just constantly on one thing to the next after the next after the next. And it's a very particular kind of relationship that's often sort of, I won't say superficial level, but a very specific thin kind of level. And so it's really nice to have a whole other dimension in the studio.
Absolutely. Well, what I love about your story, I love a lot of things about your story, but one of the things I love about your story is that you're one of these few artists that have both the left and the right side of your brain working. You know, the fact that you have a tech background, programming background is remarkable to me. And I, you know, I want to go drill down on that a little bit, but like, it's funny because every once in a while I'll bump into an artist that has an MBA and, you know, it's like they're rare breeds as well. And I was like, okay, that's really cool when you have the whole brain working. Cause of course we all know those artists that don't want to touch the business. They just, you know, or tech maybe, but then, you know, on your CV and on your LinkedIn, so on and so forth, you list yourself as an artist and a creative technologist. Talk a little bit about what that phrase creative technologist means to you and what you're trying to say with that description.
Yeah. So I actually, I don't know where to even begin. I studied architecture as an undergrad and then got really into programming. In high school, I was kind of a hacker and after architecture school, undergrad, I was like, I want to get into programming. Like it was one of the dot-com booms and it was just such an exciting time. And I got this incredible job straight away and worked as a software engineer for 6 years. And that just laid this incredible groundwork for me as a coder. But it also felt really lonely to be on the computer 10 hours a day. And I was like, there's got to be more. You know, this was in my 20s. And I was like, there's got to be more to life. There has to be like a more social dimension to all of this. And so I applied to grad school and got into UCLA and originally applied for architecture, not knowing that the art department is very good at UCLA, like no clue about the MFA program. But I got in there and started to do like 1 year of architecture school and then met Jim Welling, the photographer. And that really activated that other side of me, meeting him, going to the Hammer Museum and seeing artist lectures. I was just like, architecture is great, but in the art world, architecture is a very long road. Usually it's not till you're like 60s and 70s that you start to have any kind of say in your design studio. And here are these artists that were just like, they were doing whatever they wanted, it seemed to me. And they all had their own kind of specific area of investigation and research. And I just was completely taken by that. And so I transferred and got an MFA. But, you know, having the ability to code was just the most amazing kind of thing to have in my back pocket in grad school. I worked for, because of that skill, combined with being an artist, Andrea Fraser, I worked for Chris Burden, I worked for Joan Jonas, I worked for Fred Wilson, like artist after artist needed these like very specific kind of technical things in the studio, and I could go help them. And the word got out that I could do that. So that was just the most amazing education beyond grad school, was getting to work for all these artists. And it really only happened, I think, because I could program. I had this at the time, you know, this was in like 2005 to 2008 when I was in grad school, and it just kind of a unique combination. So yeah, that term creative technologist, I don't know that I necessarily like it. I think it comes more out of like advertising. There's a lot of roles in that kind of world where basically you're prototyping applications and then somebody else goes and implements it and does all the coding and making it supportable and buttoned up so that it can be client facing. And I still, over the years, the art world is a little bit feast or famine sometimes economically. And so I do some of that creative technology work now and again, and it's usually just, or not usually, it's always been, I mean, I haven't had a full-time job since before grad school, but I do these creative technology jobs now and then, and it's really fun. I'll get to work with an interesting team and come up with a prototype for something and then hand it off and let somebody else do the really kind of nitty-gritty implementation. But I get to do the more creative side of programming. Like, I love thinking through code as a kind of tool to work creatively and playfully. And then I get to also be in my studio. It's kind of the best of both worlds for me. Yeah.
You're spoiled like that. That's great. Yeah. You know, you're spoiled with gifts, right? And talents and intelligence. I mean, kind of what you're getting at is just the different tools in your toolbox. Language, you know, like if you're bilingual or trilingual, the more effective you can be in the world, for example, right? And just, you know, and you're talking about a language. I mean, whether it's artists who have their MBA and they speak the language of business, or someone like yourself who came up through the tech side and programming, I mean, you speak a different language, and people that don't speak that language, they can really, you can help them. Striking that balance, because you don't also, I mean, you have your own art, you have your own vision that you're building. And so balancing that, right? Because I'm guessing you can bring in extra revenue, because that's the other thing too, right? It's like the more tools in your toolbox, the more revenue streams maybe you can bring in. But at the same time, you have to be careful, right? Because it could pull you out of the studio and pull you away from the main thing, which, you know, the old saying, keep the main thing the main thing. And the main thing is your art.
Exactly. Yeah. Keeping focus for me is really important. Having those two skills, I can definitely at times find myself being like, okay, wait a minute. I gotta reel this back in. I can't read this like 500 page programming book and get into this new arcane technology.
I want to.
I have a solo show on the horizon, got to focus there.
Yeah.
But I love the kind of language analogy that you use there, because it's really how I think about it. It's absolutely, programming is a language, and it's a very particular kind of language. And so over the last couple of decades, I've thought a lot about just what a particular kind of language programming is. It's a limited set of words. It's all about rationality and precision. It's not good with nuance. It's kind of very antithetical to what art is. And that's something that both I find really comforting about it, but also really frustrating about programming and limiting, is that you are speaking this language that is so constrained and precise. And art, you know, I think more about in terms of, I've done a lot of psychoanalysis as a patient, and that's the other language that kind of opened me up, I would say, the language of psychoanalysis, the pre-association that one does on the couch, like that language is, in the same way art is antithetical in some ways to coding, pre-association is as well, like just laying down on the couch and saying whatever comes to your mind completely put me in touch with my inner world, the world that I didn't even know existed when I was programming, because I was, the only way I can describe it is I was like kind of in this repetitive loop as a programmer. And it's very comforting, as I mentioned, because you get a right answer and you know when the problem is solved. And with art, it's ambiguous. You don't know when you're done. You don't know. You're not solving anything. It's, and so being able to go between those two worlds, they're very different, but it creates for me a very rich experience. And yeah.
You're kind of getting at that, simply put, I'm a neophyte when it comes to anything tech, but you know, this idea of just objectivity versus subjectivity, right? Because art is subjective and yet programming isn't. I mean, there is it's an on or off, ones or zeros, you know, or very binary.
Yeah. And I, you know, I always think about it. Like, I played with Legos as a child. I was into drawing and Legos. That's all I wanted to do. And
nice. You sound like my son.
Yeah. But Legos are a great analogy for programming, where it's these pieces fit together in a very particular way. And there's a satisfaction when you click them together. Software for me is just like that. I was like, when I got my first job in software, I was like, wow, somebody's going to pay me to do this thing that is so, it's just like getting to play chess all day long or something and solve these logic puzzles and snap things together. It's really exciting.
But yeah, you're an artist, right? And on a certain level, artists, there's a humanity to artists that must be fed, right? And as a programmer, you somehow were being starving, like your humanity was starving on some level. You thought, my God, isn't there more to life than this? You're feeling, I don't know, isolated, lonely, whatever. And you pivoted, and good for you that you had that sense of self and that sense of courage and that ability to pivot. A lot of people fear the pivot, right? Or can't pivot. And so talk about that a little bit. I mean, because I don't want to go too macro on it, but we're living in a time where I feel like loneliness is rampant. It's chronic. And our technology, I would argue, is making us lonelier as a species. And we're social animals. I mean, it's a very interesting paradox we're in, because, you know, and you're shaking your head, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Go back to that time a little bit and talk a little bit about how you became conscious of your hunger and where are you at now, and how does your art and art making help amplify or enhance or empower your humanity?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I kind of made that pivot, I had been working at Sun for 5 years and my life started to feel a little repetitive. It just felt like, wow, I've got it all figured out. Life is clean and easy. There's not a lot of conflict. What's the big deal? Why, you know, like this is so simple. The Buddha said life's suffering. I don't know about that. Like this is really, it felt really buttoned up. And, you know, I had just met Leah, who's now my wife at the time. And I just felt like I figured everything out. And then my brother was having some issues and went through rehab. And part of that process was me going to the rehab and going to Al-Anon meetings, and all of this world opened up to me. And it just shattered this false notion I had that life was really simple and that I had figured it out and that programming was my sort of higher plane of existence and I was going to just kind of ride above all the messiness of life and the world. It just broke me open going through that. And I was like, wait a minute, I have emotions and this life and these relationships in my life that really matter. And people have real struggles and I do too. I'm just kind of using programming or these things as a coping mechanism almost and thinking I've got it all figured out. And that was a huge kind of rupture for me, but a really important one. And it just opened up a whole world of humanity to me. And those meetings really changed me. That set me on the path of programming is always going to be there. I can always get a job doing that if I need, but I want to pursue something else that is more, as you said, involves more emotion, more humanity, more of my full being as a human and my relatedness in the world, you know, that involves other people. That's something that's more social. I used to think when I was programming, you know, this is very lonely, just sitting at a computer 10 hours a day. And I have coworkers, but I rarely see them. You know, we talk all the time, but there's no closeness because it's all mediated through the computer. And yeah, you're right. You know, those things have become pervasive as technology and social media and each iteration of it digs deeper and deeper into our inner lives and our social worlds.
What a fascinating journey, because you know, I've never programmed. I programmed the VCR. Wait, do we have a VCR? Anyway, but programming is a very internal thing, right? I'm guessing, right? Like it forces you to live in your head, right? Whereas artists, being an art and making art, you have to be able to see. And you know, so many artists see the world and see yourself and then see the world. And so many artists have said, you know, find your eyes. And one artist told me that going to art school taught them how to see. And so that's really fascinating, because I'm guessing on some simplistic level, your pivot turned you from internal to external. It turned your point of view from your head around to the environment, to the space you were in externally. I don't know. It must have felt incredibly liberating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I found myself to be more receptive, more of like embodied in the world and just receiving things and paying attention. I wasn't in this endless loop in my head, in my intellect. That changed things dramatically. Yeah.
When you applied to UCLA MFA program, which, by the way, UCLA is my wife's alma mater, so you guys would get along swimmingly.
Yes.
But did you have a sense of the medium that you wanted to pursue? Were you thinking about photography? Were you thinking about painting? Like, what did you have a point of view?
I was really into photography. I think it's interesting, you know, when I was a programmer, so many other programmers were interested in photography. I think because of the technical apparatus of the camera, especially digital cameras, like, what a fascinating thing. And so that just really resonated with me. And I was making a lot of pictures up until grad school. And so that's what I originally started working with. And I did make, you know, I worked with Jim Welling, but then I also worked with this artist named Casey Reese, who developed his own programming language called Processing. I worked closely with him as well. And then I worked with Heather Robert, who's an architect. So I had this really incredible thesis committee, and I ended up making an interactive installation as well as showing photographs. So it was this kind of combination of things. But then after grad school, I went to the Whitney program in New York and really got into photography and picture making and found my own way of doing it, where I would photograph something, print out a photo of that thing, and then put, let's say it's a coffee cup, take a photo of the coffee cup, print it out so that the coffee cup is roughly the same size as it is in real life, and then put the actual coffee cup object back on top of a photo of itself, photograph it again. And I kept repeating this process. You know, it was great because it was like, here's this thing I can do that's building up a picture, a photograph in a way that's more layered and more like painting. So it felt more playful, but it also felt like, wow, this is like programming. Like, it's iterative. You make a little photo and you make another and they build up in layers. It's not just the decisive moment of a single click of the shutter. It's a kind of constructed picture through photography. But I did that for like a whole decade. But then as time went on, I started, as part of that process, drawing or painting on top of the print to have another type of mark making and create a photo or a picture, let's say, that's somewhere between a photograph and a painting. And then about 3 years ago, my last show in New York with Marion Boesky, it was like basically making paintings and then just photographing them. And so at that moment, I thought, you know what, maybe I should just show paintings instead of going through this elaborate process of trying to color correct a photo of a painting to look like the painting when I already have the painting. Like, it just kind of collapsed on itself. And then, you know, it's been a real journey to learn how to paint. Like, because I do have that technical side of myself, I wanted to really dig in and learn the history of painting, how to do it, different ways it's been done, you know. And so I took a bunch of classes with Grand Central Atelier, which is like, you know, 19th century French academic painting. It's not really featured in the art world I'm a part of so much, but I found a way to integrate some of those techniques into my process. And that's super exciting for me. Like, I actually, since last March, I've been working on a solo show of paintings, and I've never had a show of exclusively of paintings. And I'm flying to New York tomorrow to go install that show. And it'll open January 12th with Candace Mady Gallery on the Lower East Side. So it's thrilling to see that kind of arc from photography, mark making, entering the photography, and now full on oil on linen pieces. Yeah.
This is why they say, you know, it takes 10,000 hours or more, right? I mean, just and that's why they call it a practice, right? I mean, you know, that nose to the grindstone commitment to getting dirty, rolling up your sleeves, and trial and error and experimentation and exploration and just the time it takes to find your voice. Right. Yeah. It's funny, in a totally different context. I was listening to Jerry Seinfeld talk about what it means to be a stand-up comic. And he was talking about the whole thing about being a stand-up comic is discovering who you are.
Yeah.
And that process of getting up night after night, bombing maybe night after night for years, you know, to the point where you find your voice, you discover who you are so that when you get up on the stage, you can be your authentic self. That's the journey of an artist at the end of the day, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Is that the Comedian documentary that's been out for a bit? Or?
Well, actually, last night I was up a little too late and got sucked into a Netflix. It's only headliners. It's the documentary of the Chris Rock, Kevin Hart tour in New York, because they did five nights or six nights in New York where they ended up at Madison Square Garden. And anyway, so Jerry was in there talking and he was just talking about the journey of, and because Chris Rock was talking about his journey, Kevin Hart was talking about his journey, and then Seinfeld weighed in. And I just love that. It's like, no. It's about finding your voice. It's about discovering who you are. And that is just the journey of the artist, of like finding your unique self.
That's right. Yeah. That's great. I'll have to watch that documentary. Yeah. I think finding my voice, you know, and doing a lot of practice certainly helped. When I started painting, I got into the Skowhegan residency in 2008, and there were a lot of painters there. And I was like, primarily a photographer at that time. And I was like, well, I'm going to learn how to paint. Like, look at this fascinating thing these people do. It's so much more, you're out on a limb when you're making a painting. When you're making a photograph, it's very kind of, again, it's more like programming. It's more rational. There's this whole technical apparatus involved. But these painters, they're just starting with a blank canvas and trying to figure this thing out. And that must involve a lot more of your kind of imagination. And it certainly does. But I naively thought like, well, I'll learn how to paint. It'll take a year or two. But, you know, that was 2008. It's taken me a good 13 or 14 years to figure out how to paint in the way that I wanted to and have it say what I wanted to say. Like, it's a long, long process. And there's just like stacks of color studies and canvases and paintings that'll never see the light of day, but that were like completely essential to that journey. And yeah, you know, I would just say the other thing along with that kind of deliberate practice is, for me, it has been psychoanalysis, like that kind of work of working with a therapist and kind of finding out who I am and being okay with it, being okay with the messiness of being in the studio, of being sometimes feeling like I'm torn in two directions between programming and art, and being okay with the ambivalence, sitting with that. That's just been essential to keep it all going.
Yeah. Well, the show in New York, tell me about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the show is called Perfect Temperature Lava. And that's a phrase that my 7-year-old daughter, when she was like four, she came up with that. Like many kids that age, she was super into lava, and floor is lava was a phrase that she loved. And the lava just became really top of mind. And, you know, the last few years we've been living in Portland, Oregon, and we actually live in a neighborhood called Mount Tabor, which is a volcano, an extinct volcano we live on. And we look at Mount Hood and St. Helens, and there's just volcanoes all over. And just like, wow, this lava theme is really, really interesting. And last year, there was a period where I couldn't make any work. My wife was in and out of the hospital, and fortunately, she's better now. But she had some real challenges, health challenges. And I just felt all this pent up kind of energy. And last March, things finally got better for her and for our family. And I was able to paint again. And I just started making up these paintings of volcanoes. Like, I wasn't doing like plein air painting and looking at St. Helens or anything. I was just having these images or dreams and then making up these dreamscapes as paintings. And so those became the kind of background of all the paintings in the show. And there's like a waterfall that's kind of more than just a waterfall. It's like a waterfall that's kind of very excessive, and there's water coming at you. And there's a moonlit scene on the ocean with a boat. There's an avalanche, mid-avalanche. So those became the backgrounds of the pieces. And then since the photos were so layered, I've tried and tried to get that kind of layering into painting. And it just didn't quite work in the same way until I kind of discovered this motif of painting things in that atelier style that I mentioned. So really depicting them in a very modeled way, in a way that looks more realistic. And then having that object project a shadow onto that background. So there's just like the shadow becomes this bridge between the real and the imagined. And in this show in particular, there's all these imagined landscapes as the backgrounds of the painting. And those are painted pretty loosely and quickly. And then on top of them, there are these bells, these brass bells, and they're kind of suspended from string, and they appear to float in front of the picture and cast shadows onto the picture. And those are rendered in a much more, again, like atelier kind of way. And so, you know, when you're standing there looking at these paintings, sometimes you'll see a shadow and no object. And so you're kind of imagining that there's a bell hanging behind you. It kind of puts you into the painting in an interesting way as the viewer, which I really liked. Yeah, they're finally, I again took 13 or 14 years to figure out this kind of, that's me. That's what me painting is this shadow world, imagined painting and depictive objects.
Love that. I mean, you know, the fact that you're living on a volcano is such a great metaphor for life, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we're living on a ticking time bomb,
yeah.
Right? I mean, and that's just a metaphor for life. We don't like to think about our mortality, but I mean, even we could be doing everything right. And then all of a sudden there's a global pandemic. I mean, you know, like at the end of the day, right? I mean, we're part of this ecosystem called nature, which is trying to kill us because that is the destructive, creative process of life, right? Just constant push-pull. And I love the fact that you're exploring this in the role of shadows and what shadows mean. This is narcissistic of me, but I've always loved my shadow. And I just felt like my shadow was just my best friend on some level. And so I can't wait to see this body of work. How many pieces in the show?
There's 8 paintings and I'm working on a couple, and those are all larger paintings. And then I'm working on a couple of smaller ones, kind of in collaboration with my daughter again, where she makes these sculptures around the house. And I've taken photos of all of them over the years. So I have a whole cache of these things and I'm making a painting. Like the one I'm making now is she took a round cutting board, a pencil, and just a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper and sort of propped the piece of paper up vertically and had the pencil kind of holding it up. It's just so beautiful and precarious. And again, like you're saying, there is this fragility to existence and we all know how the joke ends. You know, it's like, I think too, with like, as you mentioned, the pandemic and the kind of acceleration of the environmental crisis, all of these things, that title just really stuck with me in that way too. Like I didn't want to make a show explicitly about the environment, but I also wanted to nod to that or include that idea that things are burning up like lava, but there's also this aspect of like, we have to accept that and live with it and not deny it. And that's maybe hopefully how things can change, how we can come around to doing something about it rather than denying it or pretending it doesn't exist or making the most of it, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. There's a kind of hopefulness in it too, because I think that's essential.
Absolutely. And for me, that's what those bells represent. I was looking on your Instagram. You had a couple of, I think, images of these paintings that you have in the show. And I noticed the bells that are in the foreground. I had my own idea about what you were maybe trying to say with the work, but as I'm listening to you now explain the work and I'm thinking about all of this, for me, it's becoming more and more clear in my mind that for me, those bells represent the hope in spite of all the insanity and the danger. The
That's
fragility.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I like that read on those. I was thinking of them also as a kind of music, you know, like they look like chords almost. There's like 3 or 4 bells. There's string, which is something that's involved in so many instruments. There's a kind of vibrational quality to string, of course. And I didn't intend that, but, you know, once the show came together, I was like, wow, these all feel like musical notes on top of these landscapes. And it's a joyful music, you know, it's a really celebratory kind of feeling. And the bells are, painted. They really shine. They glow in a nice way, too. And a lot of my other work in photography involved objects that my parents had given me over the years. These are bells that belong to actually my wife's grandmother, and we used during the pandemic to kind of mark time, and Freya would, our daughter would ring them when it was lunchtime, and they just became a kind of essential way of dealing with the kind of amorphous way time had become during the pandemic. And so they started to really become an important part of our routine.
How old's your daughter?
She's 7 now. Yeah.
Excellent. I have a daughter who's 11 and I have a son who's 6.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So it's lovely. My son is sort of going through this phase now where he's very intentionally drawing monsters. Like they're really good, very distinctive and singular. Every monster is different and he can knock them out fairly quickly, but he's very focused. And I'm just building this collection that I'll share with him, you know, when he, you know, on his wedding day or something. I don't know.
That's great.
But that's wonderful. So your daughter, what's her name?
Freya.
Oh, that's beautiful. So thanks. Freya, so she's showing obviously some artistic tendencies, or is this just a 7-year-old being a 7-year-old?
Yeah, I mean, we have drawn a lot over the years together, and definitely she's super into drawing, and she'll just do it on her own now, which is the best kind of thing, like with your son, the way you're pointing that out, where they can just go for it and get so immersed in this thing and be so playful. Like, that's the most amazing, amazing thing to watch. Like, I almost don't care what she does as long as it's playful, you know, and she's fully in it. That's just the most exciting thing for me to see her do that. But yeah, I think her thing that she's, from my perspective, most interested and gifted at is actually singing. She's really into singing and just has very good pitch. And she takes piano and voice lessons and just like, yeah, just floors me. I'm sure a lot of parents would say that about their kids, but so I'm so proud of her in that realm. She's really into it. Yeah.
Well, by the way, speaking of hope, I mean, our children give us hope.
Yeah. They absolutely,
you know,
do.
I mean, I'm 53 now, the world is a crazy place. The world's always been a crazy place, but the older you get, the more you know, and maybe the more tempting it is to feel cynical or nihilistic or whatever. But then I see my kids and everything's possible in their eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there really are. You learn a lot having kids. It's incredible. It really is. Yeah. Cause I, you know, before Freya was born, I was really into this psychoanalyst, Donald Winnicott, who was a child psychologist primarily. And one of his main ideas is that you're psychically healthy when you can surprise yourself through play. That's the only way you can discover the true self is through play. And I thought, God, that's really true. Like, you know, in the studio, that's when things are really working, is when I don't have an exact idea. I'm open to like watching the thing emerge and reacting to it rather than trying to direct it top down. And it's incredibly playful. And so, you know, I had all these like intellectual ideas about it and experienced it myself in the studio. And then when Freya was born, and to see somebody else in your house who's at that age where play is the primary thing, if they're given the opportunity, and to see that unfold, I learned so much from that. And it just deepened my commitment to making my own work, to see how lost she could get in something.
I believe that artists at your level, it's not a choice, it's a calling, right? Like, I don't think that you could be mentally healthy and deny your art. You have to be an artist, I would argue. I'm sure you would agree, but that's my proclamation, that so many artists are called to be artists. However, the challenge with finding your purpose, I found in my own life, is finding a balance, because when you feel like you're on a mission from God, it's hard to put it down, right? It's hard to walk away because you feel like this is my purpose, this is my mission. I'm meant to do this. I got to do this. So as a dad, as a spouse, this overused phrase of work-life balance, I mean, how do you manage that? You know, as somebody who's working you know what you're called to do, you know what your purpose is in life. If you didn't have any other responsibilities, I'm guessing you'd be in the studio 24/7 given a choice, but you do have other responsibilities. You're a husband, you're a father. How do you balance your purpose with your responsibilities? And obviously being a dad is your purpose too. But when it comes to work-life balance, how do you manage that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. As of last March, I have a studio at the house, and that's helped a lot. Having no commute, being able to walk, you know, across the little hallway and get to work, that's changed everything. For my software days, I do this technique called the Pomodoro technique, where you set a 25-minute timer, and then you take a 5-minute break. And during that 25 minutes, like, you can't do anything else. You set to a task, and whether that's making a drawing or painting, that's helped me really focus. Because yeah, like, you know, before Freya was born, it was amazing. We were living in Silver Lake, and I had only art to make and art to see and friends to hang out and talk about art. And it was just my entire life and being. And that was amazing. And I felt so lucky to have that. But then it changed. You know, Freya was born, and I just had to focus in the studio and know that, like, I'm going to keep banker's hours in the studio. And when I'm in there, it's got to be full on making work. And when I'm out there, out of the studio, then it's family time, and I have to take care of that and really be available for that too. And for me, like, making sure I take care of myself and get a run in here and there and try to focus on getting good sleep. And And then just being as focused as I can in the studio is the way I found I can kind of maximize that time, because yeah, your time is definitely limited. The one thing that is I used to read a lot more, you know, that's the thing I kind of miss is being able to really dig into a good novel or art history book or those things. Just now I'm reading with Freya, you know, mostly, but the Frog and Toad series and stuff, there's certain books, kids books where I'm like, no, this is better than anything anyone else has written. So
I hear you and I feel you, because, you know, I used to do a lot of triathlons and, you know, swimming, biking, running. And as soon as I became a dad, my free time, it just goes away, right? And you can't, I don't care what people say, we can't have it all. And you have to make choices. My fitness took a dive. Now, you know, the kids are getting a little bit older, so I'm having a little more free time and getting back in the pool now again, which is lovely and great.
Oh, but, great.
You know, but, you know, you actually, one of the things you said, I want to go back to, because, you know, I try to, when we have these conversations, I try to identify those really kind of practical things that might emerge from the conversation that could be helpful to others. You know, in this technique, this 25-minute timer, setting the timer for 25 minutes and then 5 minutes off. Talk about that a little bit, because that seems really interesting and could be helpful to others.
Yeah. So in software, like I tried all kinds of things. There's this one thing called getting things done, GTD. It's much more complicated. I've tried bullet journaling. I've tried all these different like productivity methods, but the Pomodoro technique is the most simple one. And I find the most effective for that reason. You don't, you know, it doesn't take, anybody can just start doing it right away. It's really simple. Basically, it's called Pomodoro because I think the person that came up with the idea used an Italian kitchen timer. That's a tomato. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can use your iPhone though. There are a ton of apps if you Google Pomodoro, and you set the timer for 25 minutes. And during that 25 minutes, for example, like if I'm checking email, I'll set a timer for 25 minutes and I'll know that like, this is all I'm going to do for 25 minutes and get through all these emails. And then at the end of the 25 minutes, you have 5 minutes for a break. And so I get up and walk around, and ideally you do 4 of those. So that's 2 hours. You do 4 Pomodoros in a row. And in that 2 hours, you can get a lot done. It's incredible. And it also helps you take a break. Cause if, you know, when I was programming, you're on the computer, it's really bad for your eyes to be focusing like that all the time. Like you need to get up and look at things in the distance and move your body a little bit. So it forces a break, which is really helpful. And it's really that simple. Some people write down what they do during each Pomodoro and things, but I always try to do at least a set of 2 or a set of 4 every day, at least to get through like email and all this administrative stuff, because that stuff can just creep. You know, you can be like, yeah, 3 hours can go by and you're like, oh, I spent my whole morning looking at email, catching up on the news and all these things. And there's also something interesting about it in that a lot of the timers make a clicking sound. And now it's like, you know, this is very behavioralist and Pavlovian, but like when I hear that ticking sound, it's like focus. I just turn it on and I'm like, all right, I know I got 25 minutes to get this done.
Well, it feels like as an artist, you have to be disciplined and rigorous about your privacy and isolation. If you're going deep, as I know you do, as you must, because we're living in a distraction economy or something, every notification, every alert, alarm, whatever. I mean, we're constantly being pulled in multiple different directions simultaneously. And as an artist who's trying to focus on telling a story through your art, creating a safe space, you know, and protecting that space at all costs. And it's way easier said than done, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. But, you know, having at least one kind of technique and just having the discipline to turn on that timer, that gets things going for me, at least. It is very helpful.
We're coming into a new year. I can't believe it. Where did 23 go? I don't know about you, but I'm not really one for New Year's resolutions, but I am one for kind of looking forward to the year and thinking about what I want to accomplish. What are the objectives? What's my aspiration for the year? What does success look like a year from now? Where do I want to be? That kind of thing. For you, with the new year coming, I mean, obviously you're about to go to New York. You've got a new show that's hanging and it's opening, but we got a whole year ahead. What is your vision for yourself and your practice in 2024?
Yeah, I think for me, success is always, and my vision is to find a way to keep making my work you know, because it is what I have to do no matter what. If I had to go back to programming job tomorrow, I'd still be painting every chance I got and making work. So my hope and goal for next year is my show does well enough that I can keep focused in the studio and just make my work every day. That's really, for me, the most important thing. And engaging people around that show, it's going to be up till March. We're working on programming now, but I would really love to have an artist or two come in and have a conversation with me, you know, do some walkthroughs with people. That kind of social aspect is so important. You know, to go back to Winnicott, he says the unique thing about artists is that they're the rare person who is both driven by being alone and by being visible. And so there's always this, as an artist, this back and forth between, as you were pointing out, being like going deep, being alone in the studio and being okay with that. But then also at some point you have to go out into the world and emerge. And since March, I've just been really in my head making these paintings and a bit isolated in that way, which has been productive for making the work. But now I feel like 2024 is going to be a new phase of me kind of emerging in the world again, getting out there, meeting people, talking about the work. That's really exciting and the thing that's going to kind of start that new year.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the isolation, you know, we're both sort of talk about the isolation and that is necessary and essential, right, to making good work. However, it's a blessing and a curse, right? Because being an artist alone, working alone in the studio, the ability to converse with colleagues is just impossible, right? Like you don't get, if you work in an office, right, you get those so-called water cooler moments where you can talk and share and problem solve and what have you. And it feels like, you know, one of the opportunities, and this is why I like doing the podcast, because it's like, if we can get these stories out there or create these water cooler moments where artists can hear from other artists and realize like they're not alone. Oh, by the way, other artists are having the same challenges, same problems. You know, I'm not alone. And oh, by the way, that artist solved their problem this way. I could do that too. I mean, I just wish, and so much of the work we do is about trying to create those water cooler moments where artists can learn from one another. I mean, clearly you've been very lucky, you know, in your journey in many ways to have mentors and have people who have helped you. And I don't know, what advice would you give young artists coming up? You and I mean, you were born in 77. You're 7 years younger than me, but we're still, you know, we're still getting up in years.
Oh, yeah.
But you look a lot better. So for those young artists out there, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, what advice might you give them if you were their mentor?
Yeah, I think tough to give advice in this way because it is such a personal journey. Yeah. But for me, I can say that, and I always tell this to people when I guest teach or do a lecture too, I'm like, being in therapy did more for me than grad school ever did. Like it was way more effective and helpful. Wow. In terms of getting in touch with who I am, the kind of art I want to make. And again, I think it's Gerhard Richter or somebody who said the hardest part about being an artist is putting up with the crap you come up with in the studio. There's like, it's always going to be frustrating. And what's in your mind is not going to necessarily translate into the thing in front of you. And I think therapy prepared me to be okay with that and to see the beauty in this really big difference between what you imagine and what happens in the world, and to see how that can be a really incredible thing. So definitely therapy has been a huge help, and the art world is an incredibly social realm. So getting out there and, you know, if that's working for an artist you admire for a little while, going to the gallery where you like their roster and hanging out and meeting the people there, like all that stuff's really critical, especially when you're starting out to the social realm. I don't know if that's still the case as much, but when I was coming up, that was just kind of like everything.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, so many artists I know, and I've had these conversations with so many artists over the years, it's like, they're just sort of antisocial. They don't want to deal with people. They want to be in their studio making art. And I totally get that. And I respect that. However, I've tried to encourage them, you know, that ultimately it's unhealthy and we're social animals and, you know, you need to learn how to get out there and talk to people, because of course that's where sometimes you're going to get your inspiration. You're going to get ideas, and those people skills are essential. I mean, you know, without getting into a whole nother conversation about you know, networking and selling your art and representing your art. I mean, it's funny because I've said to artists many times, like, look, it's okay to be antisocial and hate people. I hate people too. But when somebody asks you about your work, that is when you get animated. That's when you should come to life. And, you know, it's really interesting because I've seen so many artists struggle with talking about their work. You know, they count on the gallerist to do it. They count on their dealer to do it. And okay, that's fine. That's great. That's part of it too. You know, your gallerist, your dealer better be able to talk about your art. Don't just abandon your responsibility to be articulate about your practice.
That's right. Yeah. And I think it does come a lot through your social relations. As you were talking, it reminded me of when I had my interview to go to the Whitney ISP. It's notoriously a really intense interview. And so I was like, I'm going to study all these different Frankfurt School thinkers and get really deep into theory. And I was making notes. I had note cards. I was studying them. And then after the interview, I was walking in New York and I was like, you know what? I didn't use any of that theory. Everything I brought up in there was from conversations I've had with friends. And that's the stuff that really stuck with me. And that was the most important. And I was lucky enough to get in. And so that was just a really instructive moment for me. It's like, you can't study your way to being a good artist. I think there's this social realm that's super important. I mean, to the point where, you know, we moved to Portland a few years ago and it's a much smaller scene. And I was in LA before that for 14 years and I just miss it so much. We're actually going to move back to LA this summer because of that social element. That is just so critical for me, at least. And there are other ways to do it too. There are more mediated ways of socializing, as we mentioned, but I think there's nothing like being in person with somebody.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I know you're a busy man. I want to be respectful of your time. We need to probably let you go in a second. But I, you know, as we wrap up, I just want to share. I mean, like, one of the things I love about your story and your journey is that it really, you're the personification of an ideal that I've sort of, you know, talked about with other artists over the years, you know, because there's this false choice. There's this interesting, I don't know, narrative out there in the so-called art world. People will ask, well, are you a emerging or an established artist? And talk about a binary or whatever, yeah. Right? And I just like, that is a false choice, you know, because I would suggest that this is what I love about your story is that if you're an artist worth your salt, so to speak, you're always emerging.
Completely.
You know, you're always evolving. You're never established. You might as well be dead because you're not growing, maybe, right? You know, this idea that you've got to constantly improve, constantly iterate, constantly innovate, constantly emerge from where you were yesterday.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. No, I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
Great way to put
and
it.
And I think you're the personification of that. Your whole story. It's like you're constantly looking for where to grow and how to be better today than you were yesterday. And, you know, whether you got your start in programming and then architecture and then MFA and then photography, and then painting and then what's next tomorrow, who knows, but you're going to find it. And I want to congratulate you, I guess, on your success, but just commend you on your openness and your vulnerability and your commitment to constant improvement.
Thank you. That's very kind. I really appreciate that. That's a really nice way to put that. I do see that trap sometimes. When I got a gallery, for example, I was like, this solves everything. I figured out the art world. I'm now on solid ground. But as you're pointing out, as an artist, you're never the case.
The dirty little secret is, I mean, you know this too. It's like, yeah, you get that gallery, you start selling. Well, guess what? That gallery typically wants you to keep making that same work because they know it sells.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can get stuck in a dead end real easily.
Having that courage, right? To keep growing, keep changing. And John, you're one of the most courageous artists I've met. Thank you so much for your time, man. This has been wonderful.
Scott, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate that. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Before we go, of course, all of this will be in the show notes and all the stuff that we publish. But I mean, tell the listeners, well, number one, let's go back to your show that's about to open in New York so that people know, and because it's hanging till March. I want to make sure people are very clear on all that information, but also tell the listeners where they can find you online.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So for my website, which is just John Houck, John with an H, last name, Houck.com. I have links on there to my Instagram and the galleries that represent me. And then this January 12th, I have an opening with Candace Mady Projects, which I think is just Candace Mady Gallery now. She has two spaces And my solo show is going to be in the space at 1 Freeman Alley in New York City, which is basically right behind the new museum there off Bowery.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to be in New York, see January 31st through like February 3rd or 4th. So I got to come see this. Right. Are you going to be there in New York at that time by any chance?
No, I don't think so, unless there's some programming. Then I'll be there for the opening and for about a week after the opening, and then I'm going to go back for the closing. But yeah, please let me know what you think.
Hey, you're coming back to LA in the summer, right? So we'll get to hang out when you move back.
I would love that.
That'd be great. Well, good luck with the show. I know it's a nervous time, an exciting time, but lean into it, enjoy it, be present, be proud, because you have every reason to be proud. So John, thanks so much for your time, man.
Thank you as well. I appreciate it, Scott. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Not Real Art podcast. Please make sure to like this episode, write a review, and share with your friends on social. Also, remember to subscribe so you get all of our new episodes. Not Real Art is produced by Crew West Studios in Los Angeles. Our theme music was created by Ricky Peugeot and Desi DeLauro from the band Parlor Social. Not Real Art is created by We Edit Podcasts and hosted by Captivate. Thanks again for listening to Not Real Art. We'll be back soon with another inspiring episode celebrating creative culture and the artists who make it.